lies the Union fleet off Hampton Roads, Virginia, sinking two Union ships and threatening to decimate the entire group. But the North's own hastily constructed ironclad ship, the Monitor, showed up in the nick of time. On March 9, 1862, the two met in a four-hour battle that basically ended in a tie. The Virginia was eventually burned and the Monitor sunk, but their battle was significant in that it was the first battle between two ironclad ships, ultimately spelling the doom of wooden warships. After a slow start, however, the North Sea blockade was ultimately highly effective. Hairstyles and hookers. Like most major conflicts, the Civil War gave birth to a number of new terms that are still part of the American language. One of them came from the hairstyle of a Union general who wore his whiskers down the front of his ears along his jawline, but not as a full beard. His name was Ambrose Burnside, and his whiskers became known as sideburns. Another Union general, Joseph Fighting Joe Hooker, became known for the large number of prostitutes that hung around his army while it was in the Washington area. They were jokingly called Hooker's Division. Although Hooker's was already a term for ladies of the night, the general helped nationalize it and ensure its lasting place in the language. The War on Land. When it came to the ground war, the North's strategy included capturing the city of New Orleans and gaining control of the mouth of the Mississippi River. Starting in 1862, largely under Grant's command, the Union Army began taking Tennessee and slowly moving up and down the Mississippi River, cutting the South in half, just as General Winfield Scott had suggested. On the Confederate side, Lee twice took the war to the North, but both times he was forced to return to Southern territory when he was outnumbered and faced uncertain supply lines. In late 1863, the North began grinding down Lee's army in Virginia, while another Union army under General William T. Sherman marched diagonally across Georgia and then up into the Carolinas, destroying everything in its path. "We have devoured the land," Sherman wrote to his wife. "All the people retreat before us, and desolation is behind us." Here are 10 key battles or campaigns of the war. Fort Sumter. After the first Southern states seceded, they began seizing federal forts and shipyards inside their borders. Major Robert Anderson, commander of the fort in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, agreed to surrender as soon as the food ran out. But Southern forces wouldn't wait, and at dawn on April 12, 1861, they fired the first shots of the Civil War. Anderson surrendered when he ran out of ammunition, and the only casualties were two Union soldiers killed when a cannon exploded. But the fact that the South fired first helped recruiting efforts in the North. Bull Run. The first large fight of the war took place near Manassas Junction, Virginia, on July 21, 1861. Despite the fact that it was a brutally hot day, hundreds of residents from nearby Washington, D.C. came out to picnic and watch the fight, thinking it might be the highlight of what many expected to be a 90-day war. Neither army was trained or prepared, and for most of the day, utter confusion reigned. Then Confederate forces got the upper hand, and Union forces panicked and ran. The rebel army was too tired to chase them. Shiloh. Grant's army was caught napping on April 6, 1862, near this Tennessee church, and was on the brink of being routed when Grant launched a counterattack the next day that pushed the Confederate army back. The battle solidified the Union army's dominance in the West. Antietam. Lee's first push into Northern Territory took place near Antietam Creek in Maryland on September 17, 1862. The battle was fought in a narrow field between the creek and the Potomac River. It was one of the bloodiest battles of the war, with 22,000 killed or wounded. Lee was forced to return across the Potomac, providing Lincoln the victory he'd been waiting for to announce his Emancipation Proclamation. Chancellorsville. The Union Army, under General Joseph Hooker, tried to surround Lee's forces in Virginia from May 1st through the 3rd, 1863. But Lee took a brilliant gamble, divided his smaller army, and attacked first. It was a complete Confederate victory, but a costly one. Lee's top general, Thomas Jackson, who was nicknamed Stonewall for his courage and tenacity, was mistakenly shot by his own troops. He died a week later, creating a leadership hole the South was never quite able to fill. Gettysburg. Lee again pushed into Northern Territory in early June 1863, this time into Pennsylvania. In a massive battle, a total of more than 50,000 casualties from July 1st to July 3rd, Lee's army hurled itself at Union forces led by General George Meade. But the South's effort failed, and Lee was once again forced to withdraw. Considered one of the most important battles in world history, Gettysburg is also regarded by many as the most pivotal fight in the Civil War. Vicksburg. This Mississippi town was a major Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River. Coordinating the Union naval forces moving up from New Orleans, Grant masterfully moved his outnumbered army around the city and laid siege to it. Vicksburg surrendered on July 4, 1863, giving the North control of the Mississippi River. Coming within a day or two of the defeat at Gettysburg, the loss of Vicksburg was a devastating blow to the South. Chickamauga and Chattanooga. These confrontations, which ran from August to November 1863, led to Sherman's march across Georgia. At Chickamauga, Union General George H. Thomas withstood a furious attack and saved the Union Army from a rout. After the Union Army was surrounded at Chattanooga, Grant led a rescue effort and drove off the Confederate forces. The Wilderness. This was a series of battles in Virginia, starting in May 1864, in which Grant used his superior numbers to wear down Lee's army. The carnage was terrible, and Grant's critics accused him of being a butcher. But the strategy worked. Lee's army couldn't break off to try to stop Sherman's march through the heart of the South. Appomattox Courthouse. This wasn't a battle, but it was the site in Virginia where on April 12, 1865, Lee formally surrendered to Grant. The Southern army was exhausted, outnumbered, and half-starved. Grant generously fed the defeated Southerners and allowed them to go home, taking their horses and mules with them. Although some units fought on for a few more weeks, the Civil War, for all intents and purposes, was finally over. Two more reasons why the North won. Winning a war without money or friends is rather difficult, and the South had neither. Its economy, pardon the expression, went south, and it failed to convince any major European powers to join the fight on its side. The Southern economy was based solely on agriculture. When the Civil War started, there was only one iron foundry in the entire South. Still, the Confederacy's leaders put their confidence in cotton. "You dare not make war upon our cotton," a Southern politician boasted before the war. "No power on earth dares make war on it. Cotton is king." True, European nations had depended on Southern cotton to fuel their textile industries. In fact, some 80% of Britain's cotton came from America before the war. The South thought if the Union's blockade cut off Southern cotton, Britain would intervene on the South's behalf. But this idea had some holes in it. The first was that when the war started, Britain had a cotton surplus. It had stocked up when war clouds loomed on the horizon. the Brits had also started getting more cotton from Egypt and India. Secondly, British laborers hated slavery and wouldn't support the South even if that meant costing them jobs, which it did. British leaders, even those who favored the South and also favored the idea of two smaller Americas over one big one, didn't want to buck popular sentiment that supported the North. Actually, Britain and the Union came close to war a couple of times, most closely when a Union ship stopped a British ship at sea and arrested two Confederate diplomats on their way to London. This act was clearly against international law and might have given the Brits an excuse to enter the war on the side of the South. But Lincoln wisely released the two diplomats and shrugged the whole thing off as a misunderstanding. With no European allies and the Union blockade succeeding, the South's economy tanked. In 1861, about $1 million in gold-backed Confederate paper currency was circulating. But by 1863, Confederate printing presses had churned out $900 million in currency, with scarcely any gold supplies to back them. Thus, an 1863 Confederate dollar was worth about 2 cents in gold. The North's economy was also buffeted by the war. But because it was stronger going in, it handled the conflict better. Advances in agriculture and manufacturing and supplies of gold and silver from California and Nevada helped fuel the economy despite the war's manpower drain. Losing a leader. The worst manpower drain of all came on April 14, 1865, just 5 days after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox. It was Good Friday, and President Lincoln had decided to go to Ford's Theater in Washington to see the comedy Our American Cousin. Remember, at about 10:30 p.m., during the second act, an actor and Southern sympathizer named John Wilkes Booth snuck into the presidential box and shot Lincoln in the back of the head. Lincoln was taken to a lodging house across the street from the theater, where he lingered until the next morning and then died, surrounded by several members of his cabinet. "Now he belongs to the ages," said Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. Born in Maryland, Booth was from a family of prominent actors. He was a white supremacist who had plotted to kidnap Lincoln and use him as a bargaining chip to end the war on better terms for the South. But Lee's surrender changed his plot to assassination. Booth made his escape from the theater after stabbing a Union officer who was in Lincoln's box and jumping to the stage, breaking his leg in the attempt. He was cornered in a Virginia barn a week later and was shot to death or killed himself. Four of Booth's fellow conspirators were hanged. Four others were convicted of helping the conspirators after the fact and were sentenced to prison. America's Civil War lasted 4 awful years. Healing from its wounds would take far longer. Chapter 11. Putting the Country Back Together, 1865 to 1876. In this chapter, surveying the damage to the South after the Civil War, reconstructing the South and the Union, examining Johnson's road to impeachment and Grant's corrupted administration. The bullet that killed Abraham Lincoln at the end of the Civil War may also have killed any chance of coming up with a practical solution toward putting the country back together, and figuring out what to do with nearly 4 million former slaves who had won their freedom, but not much else. In this chapter, a defiant South, a wrathful and power-mad Congress, and a stubborn and nasty-tempered president combined to make a mess of what's known as the Reconstruction Period. Additionally, you'll also see how a very good military leader became a very bad political leader, and how one political party managed to steal a presidential election. A Southern fried mess, Life in the South After the Civil War. The 11 Southern states that had decided to leave the Union in 1860 and 1861 were basket cases by 1865. Only Texas, where there hadn't been that much fighting, was in relatively decent shape. Southern cities such as Atlanta, Charleston, and Richmond were in ruins. Few businesses of any kind were still operating. Little capital was available to start new businesses, and few outsiders were willing to risk investing in the area. For example, 7,000 miles of railroad track were laid in the South between 1865 and 1879. In the rest of the country, 45,000 miles were laid. Before the war, the South's economy had been based almost strictly on agriculture, mainly cotton, tobacco, and sugar, and all these industries suffered, especially cotton. Southern cotton production in 1870 was half what it was in 1860. The education system in the South had virtually disappeared, along with the old plantation system. More than 250,000 of the South's young men were gone, too. "Pretty much the whole of life has been merely not dying," wrote the Southern poet Sidney Lanier about the Reconstruction period. Two post-war changes dominated Southern life. One was the bewildering new world faced by the freed slaves. The other was a farming practice known as sharecropping, which became widespread throughout the South and would ultimately make life more difficult for both ex-slaves and poor whites. Whipped. A city of ruins, of desolation, of vacant houses, of widowed women, of rotting wharves, of deserted warehouses, of weed-wild gardens, of miles of grass-grown streets, of acres of pitiful and voiceful barrenness. That is Charleston, wherein rebellion loftily reared its head 5 years ago. I fell into some talk with a local resident. When I asked him what should be done, he said, "You Northern people are making a great mistake in your treatment of the South. We are thoroughly whipped. We give up slavery forever. And now we want you to quit reproaching us. Let us back into the Union, and then come down here and help us build up the country." Massachusetts journalist Sidney Andrews, 1865. Starting a New Life. For an estimated 3.9 million African Americans who had been slaves at the start of the Civil War, the whole of life post-Civil War had become pretty darn confusing. They had their freedom, but didn't know what they should do with it. Few former slaves had any education or training. Some thought freedom meant freedom from work. Others were fearful that to continue working for white people would put them in danger of being enslaved again. And many people believed a widespread rumor that the federal government would be giving each slave 40 acres and a mule to start their own farms. Such a plan never existed, but in 1865, the federal government did organize the Freedmen's Bureau, an agency designed to help freed slaves during their transition from slavery to freedom by providing food, education, and other support. From 1865 to 1868, the Bureau helped as many as 200,000 former slaves learn to read. About 10,000 black families were settled by the Bureau on land that had been confiscated by Union troops, although most of them were eventually forced off the land by whites who swindled them out of it or used dubious legal means. Blanche Kelso Bruce. Next time you have a $2 bill that was printed in, say, 1880, take a look at the signatures on it. One of them belongs to a Virginia native who started life as a slave and became a prosperous landowner and United States senator. Blanche Kelso Bruce was born in 1841 and worked as a field hand. When the Civil War began, Bruce escaped. He eventually settled in Missouri, where he organized the state's first school for African Americans. In 1869, Bruce moved to Mississippi, where he held a series of political offices. In 1874, he became the first African-American to be elected to a full term in the U.S. Senate. As a senator, Bruce investigated banking scandals, advocated economic aid for freed slaves, and helped obtain levee system and railroad projects for Mississippi. In 1880, Bruce was appointed registrar of the U.S. Treasury, where his duties required a facsimile of a signature on U.S. currency. He was also a lecturer, a writer, and an educator. Bruce died in 1898, having left his name in American history, and on a lot of money. Becoming sharecroppers. Remember, most blacks and many whites couldn't afford to buy land of their own, so a new form of farming became the basis for the Southern agricultural economy. Sharecropping. Under sharecropping, the farmer farmed land owned by someone else, and the two shared the profits. That was the ideal, but in most cases, the sharecropper had to borrow money to make ends meet until the next crop was harvested. This borrowing left him with so little when the crop was harvested that he had to borrow on the next crop. Thus, many sharecroppers, both black and white, became virtual slaves to debt. Many former plantation owners, meanwhile, actually did better with sharecropping than slavery, since they didn't have to feed or clothe the free sharecroppers. The sharecropping system dominated many parts of the South, replacing the plantation system. In 1868, perhaps one-third of the area's farms were tended by renters. By 1900, that percentage grew to about 70%. The system, coupled with low cotton prices and the ravages of an insect pest called the boll weevil, virtually guaranteed that few farmers could become successful, no matter how hard they worked. Piecing the Union back together. One of the topics American historians like to speculate on is what might have happened if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated. Would he have been able to come up with a widely accepted plan to reunite the states and give the former slaves their rightful place in society? Would that have led to better race relations sooner in America? Probably not. Lincoln, like most mid-19th century white Americans, felt it was impossible to just free the slaves and make them socially equal. There was an unwillingness on the part of our white people, harsh as it may be, for you free colored people to remain with us, he told a group of African Americans during the war. Lincoln's hope was to resettle the freed slaves somewhere else, either in Africa or the Caribbean. But most black Americans had no first-hand experience with any country except the United States, the country in which they were born, and they had no desire to leave. Lincoln did insist, however, that the former slaves be treated as equals when it came to the law. In 1864 and early 1865, he prodded Congress into passing the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which barred slavery. He also set out a general plan for reuniting the country when the fighting was done, assuming the North won. Under this plan, most Southerners could become U.S. citizens again simply by taking a loyalty oath. Those who couldn't, mostly high-ranking Confederate officials, could apply for the reinstatement of their citizenship on a case-by-case basis. After Lincoln was killed, his vice president, Andrew Johnson, adopted practically the same plan. Demanding loyalty, legislating equality. When 10% of a state's population had taken an oath of loyalty to the Union, the state could set up a new government and apply for readmission to the Union, as long as it agreed to give up slavery and provide an education system for blacks. By the time Congress convened in December 1865, all the Southern states had organized new governments, ratified the 13th Amendment, and elected new representatives and senators for Congress. But Congress, dominated by radical Republicans, those who sought harsh reprisals against the South for the war and immediate equal rights for freed slaves, didn't like the deal. For one thing, many of the men elected to represent the southern states in Washington, D.C., were the same people who'd run the Confederacy, including Alexander Stevens, the ex-Confederate vice president who was in federal prison awaiting trial on treason charges. That kind of in-your-face attitude irritated the radical Republicans, who felt Southerners weren't sorry enough for causing the war. Remember, even more infuriating were the Black Codes. These codes were established by Southern state legislatures to keep the former slaves under control. They varied from state to state and did give blacks some rights they hadn't had, such as the power to sue in court, own certain kinds of property, and legally marry. But the Black Codes also prohibited blacks from bearing arms, working in most occupations other than farming or manual labor, and leaving their jobs without permission. They restricted African Americans' right to travel and fined them if they broke any of the codes. To the radical Republicans, and even many moderate Northerners, the Black Codes were simply a substitute form of slavery. To combat the Black Codes, Congress passed a series of bills designed to strengthen the rights of blacks, and President Johnson vetoed them either as unconstitutional interference in states' rights or as infringing on the powers of the presidency. One thing he couldn't veto, though, was the 14th Amendment, because the Constitution required that proposed amendments go directly to the states for approval. The amendment, ratified in 1868, entitled all people born or naturalized in the United States, including slaves, to U.S. citizenship and equal protection under the law. Sorry, not. Oh, I'm a good old rebel. Now that's just what I am. For the fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fought again it. I only wish we'd won, and I don't want a pardon for anything I've done. From a popular Southern song, 1865 to 1866. Using violence to keep blacks down. Many whites in the South were outraged by the 14th Amendment, particularly poorer whites who already felt they were competing with ex-slaves for jobs. Groups such as the Ku Klux Klan, KKK, Knights of the White Camellia, and Pale Faces sprang up. They used weird costumes and goofy rituals to intimidate blacks from exercising their rights. When intimidation failed, they and other white mobs and paramilitary groups resorted to violence. Hundreds of African Americans were beaten, driven from their homes, or brutally murdered as a result of these groups' actions. The terrorist activities of the white supremacist groups were very effective in keeping blacks in their place, and the groups had de facto, if unwitting, allies in President Andrew Johnson, who seemed more intent on squabbling with Congress than solving the woes of ex-slaves, and many Northerners who were losing interest in reforming the South. Technical stuff. Blacks weren't the only targets of the KKK and similar groups. Carpetbaggers and scalawags were also terrorized. Carpetbaggers were Northerners who came to the South to participate in its reconstruction, and in some cases, make a lot of money in the process. Scalawags were Southerners who worked in concert with the carpetbaggers. Although it's true some of these people were basically just vultures feeding off the defeated Southern corpse, many of both groups actually did a lot of good, reviving the school system, helping rebuild the railroads, and so on. A lamp, a cow, and a hot, hot town. The year 1871 was a long and dry one in Chicago, Illinois. A drought had made the bustling city tinder dry, and certainly not a place to be careless with fire. But on the morning of October 8, 1871, someone was. Legend has it that someone was a Mrs. O'Leary on DeCoven Street. Supposedly, she went to her barn to milk the cow. The cow kicked over the kerosene lamp, and one of the most disastrous fires in U.S. history began. Mrs. O'Leary later denied the story. However the fire started, by the time it was out more than 24 hours later, it had killed 250 people, left nearly 100,000 homeless, destroyed more than 17,000 buildings, and done close to $200 million worth of damage. Contributions poured in from around the world, as did government help. Fortunately, the fire missed the city's vital railroad yards and stockyards, and within a few years, Chicago was able to rise from the ashes. The tailor-made president, Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson may have been the poorest president ever, at least in terms of his humble beginnings. He was born in North Carolina to impoverished parents, and his father died when Johnson was just 3 years old. He never went to school, and instead became a tailor's apprentice at the age of 14. Johnson taught himself to read and became involved in politics at the age of 17. When the Civil War broke out, he became military governor of Tennessee. In 1864, the Republican Lincoln picked the Democrat Johnson to be his vice presidential running mate. The thought was that a pro-Union Democrat would balance the ticket and attract more votes. But when Lincoln was killed, the country was left with a stubborn and ill-tempered president who had none of Lincoln's gift of leadership. Johnson didn't like blacks, didn't like rich Southerners, and didn't like the Republican-controlled Congress. In 1866, Johnson took what was called a swing around the circle, traveling around the northern states to campaign for Democrats running for Congress and against the 14th Amendment, which would give blacks full citizenship. Remember, Johnson's swing around the circle was a disaster. The president was booed and jeered by northern crowds who viewed him as a pro-South bozo. The Republicans dominated the election and had such overwhelming majorities in Congress that they easily passed any bill they wanted, and then just as easily overrode Johnson's vetoes. Pushed by radical Republicans, such as Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania and Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, Congress passed a series of Reconstruction Acts designed to force the South into line. One Reconstruction Act, passed in 1867, divided the South into five military districts, each governed by a general and policed by the Army. To be allowed to re-enter the Union and get rid of military rule, Southern states had to agree to ratify the 14th Amendment. They also had to modify their state constitutions to give African Americans the right to vote. This stipulation was particularly galling to Southerners, because many Northern states at the time didn't allow blacks to vote. Adding salt to the wound, Congress also approved and sent to the states the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed all adult males everywhere the right to vote. This amendment was passed to ensure the Southern states didn't go back on their promise to give blacks the ballot, and also because the radical Republicans were embarrassed to be from Northern states that didn't let African Americans vote. Enough Southern state legislatures were dominated by carpetbaggers, former slaves and other people whose loyalties were to the radical Republicans to ensure the amendment's ratification. However, Southern states gradually got around the law anyway by requiring blacks to pass difficult literacy and citizenship tests before they could vote. Thaddeus Stevens. He had a club foot, a razor tongue, and was one of the sincerest white men in America when it came to rights for African Americans. Thaddeus Stevens was born in 1792 in New England. He moved to Pennsylvania, where he practiced law, got into politics, and was first elected to the House of Representatives and later the U.S. Senate. Stevens was that rarity of rarities, an honest politician. He was unmoved by either flattery or criticism. But he was also fanatical in his hatred for the South, a hatred fueled in part by the destruction of his Pennsylvania factory by Southern troops on their way to Gettysburg. Stevens never married, but for years he had a black housekeeper who was rumored to be his lover. Stevens never confirmed or denied this gossip. As the most radical of the radical Republicans, Stevens virtually led the country for more than a year because of his power in Congress. He advocated taking the land from the South's wealthiest plantation owners and dividing it among former slaves. But that was too radical even for his colleagues. He did, however, successfully push for other laws designed to protect the basic rights of African Americans. When Stevens died in 1868, he was buried in a black cemetery. "I have chosen this," read his epitaph, "that I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life, equality of man before his Creator." The 15th Amendment also greatly angered many American women, who found that they were now second-class citizens to black males as well as white ones when it came to voting. One result of giving newly freed slaves the right to vote was that they elected some of their own to state legislatures. The resulting black-white governments in some states created sound, fair tax and education systems, built roads and levees, and gave property rights to women. In other states, the government was dominated by leeches and thieves of both races, although white politicians were by far the worst offenders. One carpetbagger governor managed to save more than $4 million on an annual salary of $8,000 a year. Radical Republicans weren't satisfied with being able to overturn Johnson's vetoes. They wanted him out of the White House, which, according to the Constitution, would then fall to the leader of the Senate, Ohio's Benjamin Wade. To get what they wanted, the radicals laid a trap. Congress passed a bill that required the president to have Senate approval before he could fire any of his appointees. Johnson, who believed the act was unconstitutional, promptly took the bait and fired his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, whom he considered a radical Republican stooge. Seward's folly. By 1867, Russia was ready to dump Alaska. After all, there didn't seem to be as many fur-bearing animals as there used to be, and the British might take the land anyway. It just so happened that U.S. Secretary of State William Seward was in a buying mood. Seward had heard from Americans in Russia that Alaska had loads of fish, fur, and other natural resources. Plus, buying the area would get the Russians completely out of North America and keep other European powers from grabbing the region. So, in 1867, he offered $7.2 million, about 2 cents an acre, and the Russians said, "Daw." Most Americans thought buying what they believed amounted to a distant giant icebox was dumb. The press sneered at the purchase, labeling it Seward's Folly, Wall Russia, and Seward's Polar Bear Garden. But Congress went along with the deal, in large part because Russia had been the only European country to support the North during the Civil War. Alaska became the first U.S. possession that wasn't geographically connected to the rest of the country. It also turned out to be a pretty good deal when gold was discovered there in 1897. Then, Seward's folly paid off thousands of times over. Remember, following Stanton's dismissal, Congress impeached Johnson in late February 1868 for violating the law, and the Senate put him on trial. The country regarded the whole situation as a great melodrama. Tickets to the Senate gallery were the toughest buy in town. On May 16, 1868, the first of three votes was taken to remove Johnson from office. All three were 35-19, one short of the two-thirds needed. Seven Republican senators voted against removing Johnson from office. All these men sacrificed their political careers by voting against Johnson's removal, but they may very well have preserved the U.S. government. Removing Johnson solely on political grounds could have created the basis for a congressional dictatorship, whereby Congress could dominate the presidency by threatening to dump any president who didn't go along with its wishes. The trial may also have marked the beginning of the end of Northern interest in Reconstruction. Many Northerners were as prejudiced against blacks as many Southerners. They were sick of the issue and wanted to put the war and its aftermath behind them. "The whole public are tired out with these autumnal outbreaks in the South," wrote a federal official to a Southern governor, in refusing to provide military aid when the KKK interfered in local elections. "Preserve the peace by the forces of your own state." Growing corruption in politics. When Americans elected Ulysses S. Grant president in 1868, they expected him to be the same kind of chief executive as he was a general: brave, tenacious, and inspiring. But Grant had no political experience and little political philosophy. Neither did many of the people he appointed to be his cabinet advisors and top aides. His one asset was his personal honesty, and unfortunately, it was an asset not shared by the people around him. Almost from the time Grant took office, his administration was awash in corruption. Scandal after scandal broke over the White House like waves: cornering the gold market, attempting to annex the Caribbean island of Santo Domingo, speculating on railroads, ripping off the Native Americans, and stealing liquor tax revenues were all grist for the corruption mill. Grant's administration became known as the Great Barbecue because everyone helped himself. Political corruption was by no means limited to the federal government or Grant's administration. State and local governments were tainted by scandal as well, and the country was soon caught up in what writer Mark Twain labeled the Gilded Age. It seemed everyone, including Mark Twain, was in a fever to make money, and the most money-hungry individuals became known, not always with disdain, as robber barons. In California, Collis P. Huntington and others bribed legislators and congressmen to get concessions for their railroad. In Pennsylvania, John D. Rockefeller bought and bullied lawmakers to aid his Standard Oil Company. The worst situation of all may very well have been in New York City, where a political boss named William M. Tweed created a web of elected office holders, bureaucrats, and contractors, and looted more than $100 million from the city treasury. Despite the stench of scandal from his first term, Grant was re-elected in 1872, easily defeating Democratic candidate Horace Greeley, the longtime editor of the New York Tribune. But by 1874, the scandals and the mess of Reconstruction, which ruined Republicans' chances of winning anything in the South, combined to let the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives. The shift added an ingredient of bitter partisan divisiveness to the stinky stew of corruption, but it didn't make it any more palatable. And then, an economic panic made things worse. Riding the railroads to economic ruin. America's post-Civil War economy was driven by a boom in railroad construction. Between 1866 and 1873, 35,000 miles of new track were laid, and railroads trailed only agriculture and their importance to the economic well-being of the country. For many Americans with a little money to invest, railroads seemed like a can't-miss proposition. Their enthusiasm drove up stock prices far beyond what the stocks were really worth. One such deal involved a major New York-based bank called J. Cook & Company. Cook, who had become wealthy marketing union bonds during the war and was known as the nation's financier, was trying to build a second transcontinental railroad and was seeking investors to pay for it. Sadly for Cook, and more sadly for his bank's customers, his efforts coincided with a confluence of unfortunate events. One was that banks in Great Britain raised interest rates, which meant fewer Brits were borrowing to invest in U.S. railroad schemes. At the same time, Congress decided to henceforth back U.S. currency with gold only. The U.S. Treasury quit buying silver. Silver coins and paper greenbacks were devalued. The money supply shrank, and interest rates in America rose. The economy's tailspin meant Cook's bank couldn't attract enough cash to keep its vast railroad scheme going. On September 18, 1873, the bank went under. The bank's collapse was so stunning that a newsboy in Philadelphia was arrested by a disbelieving cop for shouting out the news on a street corner. The failure triggered a flood of panic selling on the New York Stock Exchange, which actually closed down for 10 days. The stock market collapse, in turn, touched off a deep economic recession that lasted into 1879. Scores of other banks failed, about a quarter of all U.S. railroads went belly up, thousands of auxiliary businesses closed, and unemployment rose to 14% by 1876. The country desperately needed strong, honest, and calm political leadership. What it got was the most tainted presidential race in its history. Bounce this idea off the wall. Dr. Benjamin Franklin Goodrich was a Civil War surgeon who became an Ohio businessman after the war. His business was finding things to do with rubber, which a fellow named Charles Goodyear had figured out could be treated with high heat and sulfur, a process called vulcanization, so it would stay flexible under hot or cold conditions. Goodyear died in debt in 1860 before he could find a practical use for the substance. But Goodrich, who had watched a friend's house burn down after a leather fire hose burst, knew exactly what he wanted to produce. In 1870, his company began making the world's first rubber hoses and one of the first rubber products of any kind. By the following year, rubber gaskets, bottle stoppers, clothes wringer rollers, and other items were being produced. Watering can manufacturers may have cursed them, but to gardeners and firefighters, Goodrich's hoses were a godsend. Fixing a presidency, and not in a good way. With all the corruption and the public's growing disgust, it wasn't surprising that in 1876 both political parties nominated presidential candidates known for their integrity. The Republicans put up Rutherford B. Hayes, a former Union general who had been governor of Ohio for three terms. The Democrats countered with New York Governor Samuel B. Tilden, who had gained admiration for helping bring down the Boss Tweed Ring in New York City. Remember, when the returns came in, Tilden had beaten Hayes by more than 250,000 votes and appeared to have captured 203 of the 369 electoral votes. But Republican Party leaders, who controlled the people who oversaw the elections, arranged to invalidate thousands of Democratic votes in Florida, South Carolina, Oregon, and Louisiana, which changed the electoral vote count to 184 to 165, with 20 votes in dispute. Naturally, the Democrats challenged the new results, and a special commission was created to look into the matter. The commission consisted of 10 members of Congress, 5 from each party, as well as 5 members of the Supreme Court, 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats. The commission voted 8-7, not surprisingly along party lines, to give all 20 disputed votes and the election to Hayes. Northern Democrats were outraged, but Southern Democrats saw an opportunity and offered a deal. They agreed to drop any challenge to the commission's vote if Hayes promised to remove the last of the federal troops from southern states and let the states run their own affairs. The Republicans eventually agreed, and Hayes became president. As a result, the Reconstruction period came to an ignominious end. African Americans were largely abandoned by the federal government, and white Americans outside the South turned their attentions elsewhere, mostly to the West. Indigestion on Wheels. One day in 1872, a man from Providence, Rhode Island, one Walter Scott, loaded a wagon with sandwiches, boiled eggs, and other food, and parked it outside a downtown newspaper office in the evening. Because all the restaurants in town closed at 8 p.m., Scott had plenty of customers. Soon, other lunch wagons began rolling down streets all over American cities. In 1884, a guy in Worcester, Massachusetts, named Sam Jones, got the idea to put stools in his lunch wagon so customers could sit down. The wagons drew complaints from residents and competing restaurant owners and were banned or restricted in many towns. So the wagon owners simply rolled their wagons onto vacant lots, took off the wheels, and called themselves restaurants. By the 1920s, people were eating as many breakfasts and dinners at the wagons as lunches, and rather than lunch wagons, people started calling them diners. Part 3. Coming of Age. In this part, learn how the United States matures as a country after the Civil War. Watch America emerge as an economic world power. Jitterbug through the Roaring Twenties. Get depressed by the Great Depression. Go to war with America and the rest of the world. Chapter 12. Growing Up, 1876 to 1898. In this chapter, cashing in on animals, minerals, and vegetables, pushing non-whites out, watching big business boom while unrest settles in, remembering some forgettable presidents, battling with Spain for some islands. Americans have always been restless, and in 1876 they were hungry, too, for success. There seemed to be many ways and places to be successful, and success seemed very important to a whole lot of people. In this chapter, the country starts its final push toward filling in the gaps between the coasts, and its final pushing aside of the original Americans. Railroads help do both, as well as usher in the birth of truly huge businesses. A string of mediocre presidents don't do much of anything, and a war with Spain launches America on the road to becoming an empire. Heading West in a Quest for Wealth. When settlers in America first started moving west, about 10 minutes after they got here, they generally did so because of the lure of free land and the chance to put down roots. After the Civil War, however, Americans moved west as much to make a buck as to settle into a new life. The West was seen as a bottomless treasure chest of resources to exploit. Making money from minerals. Some of those resources were minerals. Starting with the California Gold Rush of 1849, the West saw a steady stream of gold, silver, and copper discoveries touch off other rushes as hordes of miners careened like pinballs from strike to strike. In 1859, thousands descended on Pike's Peak in Colorado looking for gold. Later that year, it was the Comstock silver lode in Nevada. In 1861, it was Idaho. In 1863, Montana. In 1874, the Black Hills of Dakota. And in 1876, it was back to Colorado. Towns with 5,000 inhabitants or more sprang up virtually overnight, composed of miners who would be millionaires, and the gamblers, thieves, swindlers, prostitutes, and liquor sellers who accompanied them. They formed violent societies. Justice was often in the form of vigilance committees, or vigilantes, who set themselves up as the law and sometimes didn't bother with a trial before stretching a defendant's neck. Where most of the mining money went reflected what was happening in the rest of the country. Big corporations, financed by stockholders from the East as well as Europe, had the capital to buy the equipment needed to mine on a large scale, and they reaped most of the profits. Most miners made little, and many of them ended up going to work as laborers for the large companies. Remember, but mining had some positive impact on the West besides the wealth it created. The miners were the first to open much of the West, and they helped encourage the railroads to come. Some of those who came for the booms stayed on after the inevitable busts that followed. Because miners had to set up governments in a hurry to deal with the instant towns, political organization took root. Coupled with the mineral wealth, these organizations gave the mining areas clout in Congress. This helped speed the admission of new states, such as Nevada. By the dawn of the new century, the big fever-producing mineral strikes were over in the West. But they were replaced by the rush to extract oil, black gold, beneath Western lands, particularly in Texas and Oklahoma. Making money from animals. After the Civil War, Texas soldiers returned to find as many as 5 million cattle roaming around the state. The cattle were descendants of animals brought to the area hundreds of years before by Spanish explorers. There was plenty of grazing land and enough water, and the cattle were a hardy breed. Now, Texans were as fond of beef as the next state's inhabitants, but they really wanted to find a way to share their wealth on the hoof with the rest of the nation. Cattle worth $3 to $4 a head in Texas could be sold for 10 times that much in eastern states, if you could get them there. Cattle drives to the east and even California had been tried before. But many of the cattle died before the drives were over, and the survivors were worn thin by the effort. After the war, however, someone got the idea to shorten the distances by driving cattle to the railroads that were moving west and then shipping them east by rail. Rail met cow at trailheads in Abilene and Dodge City in Kansas, Ogallala in Nebraska, and Cheyenne in Wyoming. By 1871, 750,000 head of cattle were moving through Abilene alone. By 1875, the advent of the refrigerated car allowed cattle to be slaughtered and butchered in Midwest cities like Kansas City and Chicago before being shipped east. The rise of the cattle industry also gave rise to an American icon, the cowboy. Hollywood turned the cowboy into a romantic figure who was quick on the draw with a six-shooter and spent most of his time drinking whiskey and playing poker in town, with a dance hall girl hovering at his shoulder. In truth, the cowboy was more likely an ex-Confederate soldier or former slave who spent most of his life on the back of a short-legged cowpony, hundreds of miles from the nearest bar or woman. He was brave and tough, but he was far less likely to use his pistol on his fellow man than he was on rattlesnakes or as a noisemaker. he was likely in his late teens or early 20s, and about 1 in 5 was African American. He worked for $25 a month and ate beans, bacon, and black coffee day after day. By the early 1890s, the day of the cowboy and the cattle drive was coming to an end. Like other aspects of American life, inventions, such as barbed wire, and investments by Easterners and Europeans turned ranching into big business, and cowboys became caretakers on large fenced ranches rather than riders of the range. A far less glamorous but much more numerous type of Westerner was now dominant, the sodbuster, making money from vegetables. In the wake of the miner and the cowboy came the farmer. The railroads were eager to colonize the areas they controlled with potential customers and offered land near their tracks through giant advertising efforts in the East and Europe. The federal government tried various ways to sell public lands, most of